On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In defining his war on terror, President Bush has not been shy about World War II analogies. Today's enemies, he has said, are successors to fascists, to Nazis. But there is at least one big difference. In World War II, Franklin Roosevelt led the country to complete victory over Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in just 3 years and 9 months. With Afghanistan and Iraq, George Bush is 6 years in, still fighting, and by no means clearly winning. Big national security thinkers are asking why. One reason may be America's World War II formula for success has been ignored. Up next on Point, war lessons. Later in this hour, we will hear from historian and military thinker Andrew Bacevich, politically conservative West Point grad, retired Army colonel, and longtime critic of the Iraq War. His son died last month serving in Iraq. But first, joining me in the studio is Stephen Van Evra. He's professor of political science at MIT and a big student of international relations and U.S. national security. He's author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. His latest essay in the journal Middle East Policy is titled The War on Terror, Forgotten Lessons from World War II. Stephen Van Evra, thanks very much for being here.
It's great to be here, Tom.
So that was a great big war, 3 years and 9 months, the American piece of it, and decisively won. You're looking at what we learned then, how we did it then, and what we've forgotten now. And I guess the first question to ask, maybe, we all look back on the victory in World War II as inevitable, was it?
No, it wasn't. There was many ways we could have goofed the war up and either won it at much greater cost or lost the war or lost the peace. We could have had a much worse war if we'd not set priorities correctly. Roosevelt's strategy was to go after Germany first because it was the biggest threat. Even though Japan was the first to attack.
Right. You've got a bunch of great big pieces, and I want to have a little bit of a workout with you. It's a very interesting way to get some perspective on what we're doing now. The first, you've got, I don't know, it's half a dozen, eight, nine different areas where we may have diverged from World War II strategy, and this is the first one, setting priorities. Describe what happened then and what you're seeing now.
Then we were attacked by Japan, but the Roosevelt administration judged Germany to be far the greatest threat, and it pursued a strategy of what was called then Germany First, which was to check Japan in Asia but focus U.S. resources on Germany, because the American thinking was that if Germany wasn't attended to first, it might defeat Britain and then could dominate the Atlantic.
So don't go all out at Japan at first. Keep it in check, but pour the U.S. attention and resources on one primary target.
Correct. And if the U.S. hadn't done that, Germany might have been able to consolidate its hold on the continent, conceivably even defeat the Soviet Union, and would have posed a much tougher problem down the road U.S. invasion of Europe. Possibly even Germany might have gotten atomic weapons.
So choices were made, targets were prioritized, and that lesson, well, it worked out pretty well, but is it being followed this time?
No. Today our most dangerous enemy is al-Qaeda, and we are not focusing on al-Qaeda. The Bush administration focused on al-Qaeda for the first few months after 9/11 by attacking al-Qaeda's redoubt in Afghanistan, but then it lost focus and directed its attention to other projects. It went after Iraq, and it did that before it had firmly defeated al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. It took resources away from the war in Afghanistan. As a result, the al-Qaeda leadership escaped into Pakistan. They're still there. They're reasserting control over their global network, and once again, they pose a very serious threat to the United States.
So the cost of ignoring this lesson of World War II by your light, Stephen Van Evra?
That we still face a serious al-Qaeda threat. Al-Qaeda's out there. They're looking for weapons of mass destruction. They're trying to bring them to our cities. They're still able to hurt Europe, as we've seen them do repeatedly, and we have been unable to knock them out.
Next strategy lesson from World War II, mobilizing resources.
During World War II, Roosevelt was unashamed of asking the American people to sacrifice heavily for the war. He moved U.S. defense spending up from 2% of gross national product to 54%.
54% of GNP?
Yes, yes. Wow. Most of what Americans were producing was then going to the war effort. He instituted the draft in 1940 against a lot of opposition. He instituted rationing. He asked for sacrifice from everybody. Today, the the Bush administration has not asked anyone to sacrifice except our armed forces, especially our reserves. And
with repeated tours of duty with 29,000 dead and injured at this point?
Correct. And they are sacrificing, but the rest of us aren't. The rest of us are being told to go shopping, if you recall, to pep the economy up back there in 2001.
So if it's as important as World War II, if we're drawing that analogy, we may be doing it rhetorically, but when it comes to what we're actually funneling to winning?
We're not doing enough. Both the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan have been waged on the cheap.
But we've been told that these are huge. We're spending, $2 billion? I forget, $2 billion a week? I mean, it's some astounding figure. Is it really so small?
One rule about war is you want to go in and win decisively at the outset, because if you don't, it's like a peat fire. The mess you create gets
goes
into the ground
and
burns and burns. Yeah, and you can't get rid of it. So what we've seen is in Iraq, if we'd gone in with a big enough force at the outset, we might have been able to avoid the insurgency. But now we face an insurgency that's much harder to get rid of than it would have been to prevent. Same in Afghanistan. The Bush administration under-resourced the war afterward. They put very little resources into giving Hamid Karzai the security help he needed or the economic help he needed. Now we see the Taliban are back. Now getting rid of them is like an infestation. It's going to be very hard to get rid of them.
World War II lessons forgotten, price being paid. Next strategic point, forging alliances and deals, then and now.
We won World War II on the backs of our allies. Americans think that World War II was won by, the heroism of U.S. troops. In fact, U.S. battle deaths were only 3.7% of the total battle deaths of the allies in World War II.
3.7%?
Yes, yes. The U.S. allies took, over 96% of the battle deaths lost.
And we're talking primarily Russia.
Right. Russia, China, Britain, France, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Those are the main allies.
But this time it's our boys and now girls.
Yes, exactly.
In the grinder.
Right, exactly. There's a larger lesson here, which is America had great success in world affairs in the 20th century because it was able to marshal allies to pay the biggest blood price and economic price for our success in World War II and in the Cold War, and in World War I, for that matter.
But do we have potential alliances like that now? Nobody's stepping up to take these losses now that I can see.
Well, because the Bush administration hasn't made mobilizing allies a priority. You'll recall that after 9/11, our NATO allies voted a NATO emergency and announced that they were willing to declare themselves at war with terror and to send forces to Afghanistan. And the Bush administration basically blew them off and said, we don't need your help. The view of the Bush people sort of early in their administration was that allies are more of a hindrance than a help.
And never mind NATO allies. In World War II, FDR worked with Joseph Stalin, one of the country's greatest avowed enemies.
He was willing to work with lots of bad guys. Stalin, a horrible man, mass murderer. Joseph Broz Tito, the murderous leader of Yugoslavia. Chiang Kai-shek, an odious leader in China. So he would make deals with the devil to beat the worst devil.
And we won, and the victory monuments are all over. The cost of dropping that lesson from World War II?
Now we're all alone. I mean, not completely alone, but we bear the prime cost of the war on terror, especially the prime cost of the war in Iraq. Our losses are high, and the dollar costs are huge because we're doing this with a small help from others. Only the British are really giving us important help in Iraq.
It's a rich list, and it goes on. Next strategic point of comparison, waging the war of ideas then and now.
Roosevelt understood that shaping the public opinion in the U.S. and abroad was crucial to victory, that if the world thinks you're the good guys and approves of your goals and thinks you're working to help make their lives better, they'll help you. And he invested lots of energy in mobilizing Hollywood and other media resources to tell America's tale to the world and to convince the world that the Allied cause was the right cause. He had Frank Capra making those famous films, Why We Fight. And much of Hollywood was mobilized to this effort.
But I can imagine people saying, but Hitler was an easier target. He was so disgusting to the Islamic world. Bin Laden doesn't look so potentially so odious.
It's true that U.S. Enemies in World War II were very grotesque and easy to paint as the bad guys. But it's true today.
Shouldn't it be anyway?
It should be, yes. I mean, the idea that we're losing a public relations war to Bin Laden, I think, is a disgrace. Bin Laden is a thoroughly grotesque figure. He's murdered thousands of Muslims. His political idea of an Islamist tyranny has already been tried in Afghanistan and in Sudan and in Iran and shown to fail.
You say that the United States is losing a public relations contest to such primitive thugs is an appalling failure and a disgrace on those U.S. officials responsible. What have we forgotten here? Is there some idea we've got in the closet we should pull out? Why is it so hard to promote, to trumpet an attractive American vision that would potentially, trump bin Laden?
Well, I think the Bush team early in the war on terror didn't think the war of ideas was important. I think they defined the main problem in the Mideast to be that people weren't sufficiently frightened of the United States, that they didn't put put credibility behind U.S. threats.
And never mind if you respect us, fear us.
They had exactly. They sort of had the Caligula theory of statecraft. Let them hate us as long as they fear us. And they were overlooking that we also need to persuade the world to come to our side.
Next
and they put very little money into this. Only $1.3 billion is now being spent on public diplomacy to shape world opinion, even still today. And only a small fraction of that is aimed at the Muslim world. This is a tremendous blunder.
And if that idea battle is lost in the Muslim world, you've got a billion Muslims tilted against the United States.
1.3 billion, Tom.
Okay.
I hate to give you the bad
news. It's great. God bless them. But the battle of ideas is critical. If you get a great big population that is just soured on anything to do with the United States, you've got built-in problems.
We can't end the terror problem against the United States until we cause a change in the terms of debate in the radical wing of the Islamist wing of the Muslim world. This is a prerequisite for success.
Next piece, soft landing for the defeated. It looks anything but soft these days in Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter.
Part of winning the peace in World War II was to reform the defeated states and bring them back to the civilized world and, in fact, mobilize them for the Cold War against the Soviet Union. And the U.S. put lots of effort, lots of money, lots of talent into bringing Germany, Japan, and also Italy and Austria into the Western world and getting them going in a good direction.
Now, we come to a couple of others here. Creating a peaceful order, how the United States approached that under FDR, Marshall, and the rest. And bringing in the best people. Look back then and now, please.
FDR understood that it was important to work hard to create a peaceful order in the world that the U.S. would dominate in 1945, and it created institutions to ensure that the new world would be peaceful, the new economic order so that free trade would flow, a U.N. which had some peace-causing benefits. The net benefit of these efforts was to create peace not between East and West but within the West so that the West could be united. Roosevelt didn't foresee this, but it was very important that these institutions exist so that the relationships among the Western powers were well-oiled and therefore the West was ready for the Cold War and ready to contain the Soviet Union and in the end to defeat
it. And now he was just over for the G8 meeting. He's talking with the folks.
Well, the Bush team put very little effort into bringing Iraq and Afghanistan to a peaceful solution, and they've also failed to understand that peace on the periphery of the Muslim world is very important. Al-Qaeda lives on war. Al-Qaeda thrives on war. They recruit using the bloody shirt of those who die in wars involving Muslims in their recruiting message. And so the Arab-Israeli conflict is gasoline for their fire. The Kashmir conflict helps them recruit and helps them train. The war in Iraq itself does. The Chechen conflict does. So the U.S. should be in the peace business. If you want to defeat al-Qaeda, you want peace in the Muslim world, peace in the periphery of the Muslim world. The Bush team has basically gone AWOL on the peace mission. They've let the Israeli-Palestinian conflict fester. They've done nothing to bring an end to the Kashmir conflict, and they've gone into Iraq and started a war that al-Qaeda is thriving on.
The best people. Roosevelt put outstanding folks in place. Look then and now, please. I mean, he had Dwight Eisenhower and Omar Bradley and George Patton and Chester Nimitz and William Bull Halsey and many more.
Yes, Roosevelt picked as his chief strategist in World War II, General George C. Marshall, who was a brilliant leader and a brilliant strategist, who himself was a stickler for competence. He was famous for his little black book, which he'd kept for many years, in which he took notes on every officer he ever met, judging whether this person was fit for command or not.
And he was just one of a great team. How about now?
Well, I was going to say, Marshall then selected the best team to ever run our armed forces in wartime, I believe. Today, I think Bush has tolerated poor performance by many people on his team. He's pointed to people based on ideology, not on competence. And then after they've performed poorly, he's left them in office. The best example is Rumsfeld, who committed epic blunders in his management of the Iraq War. You know, the list is a yard long, ranging from not going in with enough troops, failing to plan the post-war, disbanding the Iraqi army, so on and so forth.
Point taken. I have you for so little time, and there are callers. I want to get to these last couple of points. Uniting Americans. I was struck by this. I didn't know this, how Roosevelt had put aside his rather dramatic politics. He declared that Dr. Win the War has replaced Dr. New Deal. He put his politics on ice to some extent.
Yes, he dropped his divisive domestic program, the New Deal programs, and proclaimed that he was now moving to a new program, Dr. Win the War. And he appointed Republicans to high positions in his war cabinet, including Frank Knox, who'd been the Republican vice presidential nominee in 1936. He made him Secretary of the Navy. He made Henry Stimson a Republican Secretary of War. He also brought in other Republicans to run the war, Lovett and others. So he had a unity policy, whereas the Bush team have had they've not pursued a unity policy on the war. They've basically excluded Democrats from consultation, from policymaking, and they've used the war as a political weapon in political campaigns.
Forgotten lessons from a war well and quickly won. Let's turn to our listeners. Bill is calling from Holliston, Massachusetts.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
What do you think, Bill?
Yes, just a question. I was wondering, I think the history in and of itself, learning about history is valuable, and the points that are being made are valuable in and of themselves, but I'm just wondering about the comparison, because the war seems so different. We have a war on a concept like terror. Can it be won as a valuable argument? And just considering the different presidencies, comparing Roosevelt to George Bush.
And just on the basics, I hear you asking there, Bill, and our time is short, but that's a great question. Stephen Van Ever, here we've got not the armored ranks of German panzers and Japanese Zero fighters, but terrorists. We've got guerrilla war. We've got sectarian war to a greater extent than we had in World War II by far. Are these apples and oranges?
Well, Bill's right. These wars are different in some ways, but they're similar in others. The most important different way is that World War II was an interstate war against a major power, and the war on al-Qaeda is a basically a global guerrilla war, if you will, quite different in its nature. But there are some eternities to war, some constants that are true in every war, that setting priorities will lead to a better result than failing to do it, that you better go after your main enemy first, whoever that is, that you should find allies where you can and ask them to bear as much burden as you can. This is always going to reduce your costs, that you should solve problems the cheap way instead of the expensive way, and often persuading people that your cause is right is the cheapest, easiest way to get their help instead of using force. That you need to appoint the best people. For sure, in every war, you're going to do better when your finest are in charge rather than when your B team is in charge.
So whatever the parameters, these apply. Jackie's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air.
I think we've all forgotten that at the end of World War II, which we all supported, that Roosevelt and Winston Churchill of England, Great Britain, and also General Eisenhower, our future Republican president,
yes,
all said we must have no more wars. And yet, for no reasons, we have had 8 wars, all considered preemptive wars, wars of choice. And this is only, we're the only country in the world.
I don't know if they're all preemptive, but there sure have been a lot of them. What do you take from that, Jackie? You say we're just too trigger happy?
Well, just recall what Eisenhower said. Beware the military-industrial complex. And let's not forget, I'm sorry to say it as a Democrat myself, that the Democrats voted for this war, enough of them, so the war went on. Although, of course, Congress did not declare this war. The president just went at it when he got a certain kind of resolution.
Right. Jackie, let us pick that up. My time with Stephen Van Ever is short. Steve, what about it? I guess two things. Are we too quick to go to war as a country? I mean, it took Pearl Harbor to get us into World War II. People have said 9/11 is like that. Are we too quick?
I think we've been down through the last century both too quick sometimes and sometimes too slow. I think the U.S. was too slow to mobilize against Germany in the 30s. But I think that we, I'd love to review with you the Cold War. I think the Vietnam War was a mistake. We should have stayed out. I think that crossing the 38th parallel in 1950 was a mistake.
And Korea.
Yeah, we should have gone into Korea, but we should not have expanded.
Provoked the
North
Chinese
Korea
to pour in.
Exactly. So we made big mistakes in the Cold War. We always do. That's part of the warp and woof of managing world affairs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great thing to talk about. But it could have been a lot worse. If Roosevelt had not managed the end game in World War II correctly, the Cold War could have been a much tougher business. It could have been lost. We could have failed to contain the Soviet Union.
Why do you think the lessons of such an important war that all Americans, not just big security thinkers, but everybody looks up to World War II and salutes that as the way it can and should be done? How could we forget lessons of such a war?
You know, this gets into another subject, but I'm disturbed that American public culture doesn't study diplomatic and military history more. Our colleges and universities are increasingly not teaching it as a subject. History departments across the U.S. are increasingly not teaching political, military, and diplomatic history in their course offerings. And this is a very dangerous thing that's going on. You should do a show on it.
But in our White House, in our Pentagon, in the halls of power, those people don't know?
Well, there's a broad public culture here, I think, of Americans not thinking that history is serious business and that studying the past is a serious thing to do. I also think within the Bush team, there is a bad feeling about past U.S. policymakers. They think in general that those who came before them were wimps and that they don't have much to learn from past American policymakers. So they tend to be somewhat dismissive of the need to study and learn from those who came before them.
We live and learn, and the lessons can be painful. Stephen Van Evra is professor of political science at MIT. His most recent essay in the journal Middle East Policy is The War on Terror, Forgotten Lessons from World War II. Stephen Van Evra, thank you very much for joining us today. I want to turn now to another big security thinker, if I may. Andrew Bacevich joins me in the studio. He's a professor of international relations and history at Boston University, a U.S. Army veteran himself, served in Vietnam and the Gulf War, retired U.S. Army colonel, West Point graduate. His recent op-ed piece in the Boston Globe is called Joint Failure. Recent op-ed piece in the L.A. Times is More Troops, More Trouble. It should be noted that his son, 27-year-old First Lieutenant Andrew J. Bacevich, died in Iraq on May 13th this year as a result of a suicide bomber. Andrew Bacevich opposed the war. Long before that, he has continued to think vigorously about it since. We're honored to have him with us today. Andrew Bacevich, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, glad to be with you.
You're looking first and foremost here at the structure of our leadership in this war and looking at the Joint Chiefs of Staff in particular. Remind us, what is this institution? What was it created to do? And why are you so critical of it today?
Well, I'd pick up on one of the points that Steve Van Evra was making about the quality of the leadership that that is present in trying to guide this war. And I think you could make the argument that our senior military leadership has been tremendously disappointing. Now, the Joint Chiefs, the modern Joint Chiefs, were created in 1947 as part of the reorganization of the national security apparatus post World War II.
But weren't they created in part in response to the lessons of World War II that Stephen?
Oh yes,
we thought this was the way to go. This was the FDR formula.
It was the FDR formula, and indeed, yes, it was the appreciation of the role played by people like General Marshall. Mm-hmm. And others of the Joint Chiefs, as they were then called, but mm-hmm. only existed because Roosevelt said they should exist, not because they had any congressional legislative
institutional
basis.
Structure, yeah.
And so the idea in 1947 is we're going to reinvent that institution, we're going to make it permanent, mm-hmm. we're going to define it, we're going to create a body of senior military officers who will provide advice to the decision makers, so that the decision makers will craft wise policies, will avoid the wars that can be avoided, and will wage successfully those wars that cannot be avoided.
That is the civilian decision makers, the deciders, the president. Right. So this was the interface at the top of the military, right, with the top of our civilian structure.
Yeah, the Joint Chiefs are not commanders. They are advisors to the civilian leadership that makes the basic decisions, mm-hmm. To the Secretary of Defense and to the President. And I mean, the firing, the de facto firing of General Peter Pace
last week,
the current chairman, mm-hmm. To me is one more indication of the extent to which this institution, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has simply not served the nation well. Now, when Pace is let go, I mean, I say fired, he's simply not reappointed for us, mm-hmm.
right,
for what is usually a second two-year term.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary of Defense Gates appoints Admiral Mike Mullen to replace him and says that, you know, Mullen's a good guy. I'm sure,
right,
Mullen is a good guy, and that
Admiral Mullen,
this is going to fix the problem. And I think I think even if Admiral Mullen is a good guy, that this institution is so dysfunctional, has come to be so dysfunctional over its 60 years of existence, that a better approach is not to simply appoint a new guy to be in charge, mm. but to consider scrapping this system and create new mechanisms for providing military advice to the president, because we do want good military advice to be provided.
Well, but we do have to have an interface between the civilian and the military. They do need advice. What's wrong with this current structure, and how would you begin to change it?
Well, I think the problem does indeed go all the way back to the 1940s, when there were tremendous struggles between the military and the senior leadership over a wide variety of issues connected to nuclear weapons, connected to budgets, to basic strategy, mm-hmm. to racial desegregation. And the point is that the Joint Chiefs from the 1940s have tried to intrude into arenas that actually properly belong to the civilians.
You said the history here is one of conniving, double dealing, and mutual manipulation. You remind us of Dwight D. Eisenhower, of course, a former general himself, as he left the presidency in his farewell address, warning that the military-industrial complex, his word, could well, quoting him, endanger our liberties, our democratic processes. You say that that amounted to a tacit admission that he, as commander-in-chief, had lost control of his generals on the Joint Chiefs?
Because when you look at the history of the administration, the civil-military history is one in which senior military leaders were constantly trying to undermine or to change Eisenhower's basic policies. I mean, a very good example of that, and this is the question here is not whether those policies were smart, mm-hmm. although the civilians need to decide, but a good example of that is the strategy of massive retaliation, the reliance on nuclear weapons, and the Army certainly, and this hurt the Army in a budgetary sense. Senior Army leaders like Matthew Ridgway and Maxwell Taylor exerted themselves to find all sorts of ways, press leaks, going to Congress, to try to discredit the basic strategy of the President of the United States.
But this time out, the dynamic feels the other way around. It's been military officers who have been discredited by civilian leaders.
Well, and
Shinseki by Rumsfeld and so on.
It is the civilians have learned the lessons of the Eisenhower era, of the Kennedy era, and the big lesson that they have learned is to try to marginalize the military. And what we see, and I think, sadly, General Pace is a good example of this, the way to marginalize the Joint Chiefs is to appoint to the Joint Chiefs people who are pliable, people who don't rock the boat, people who are accommodating, who will go along. That's what we've gotten in General Pace.
So instead of our best advisors, our clearest thinkers, our strongest thinkers and voices.
Right. And instead of the people who will say, Mr. President, this will fail, or Mr. President, this enterprise, let's say the invasion of Iraq, will produce complications that we cannot possibly foresee.
Of course, Colin Powell talked like that. He was that kind of chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Well, he was. But of course, again, Powell, as I tried to explain in the piece, Powell also overplays his hand by intruding into all sorts of areas where he should not have strayed.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to our listeners. Bill is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
And Andy, let me send my condolences to you, heartfelt. Anyway, going to the program, what do you see as the decision mechanism, if not the JCS, some independent form like a Colin Powell sitting on the Hill somewhere?
Well, again, it's not decisions, of course, it's advice. But frankly, yes, what I suggest in the little piece that I wrote for the Boston Globe is that we separate the advisory function from the function or the responsibility of managing the services, which is what, of course, the service chiefs do on a day-to-day basis. And I think we might want to give some consideration to creating a forum of wise men. And wisdom is what, above all, we want to be able to provide to the President and the Secretary of Defense, wisdom and candor. And I think the ability to rise above both parochial considerations and partisan considerations. And so these wise men might be retired officers, but I would say not necessarily the retired four-star officers. The four-stars aren't necessarily the wisest people. The wise men, and of course it could be women as mm-hmm. well, but the wise men might not even be retired officers, might be people who have spent their lives studying warfare and military affairs, but some separate advisory body that the President and the Secretary of Defense could turn to with a high level of confidence that they would be receiving sound advice, not tainted by partisan or parochial considerations.
So a key thing you're saying there is you would separate this out, a body of advisors you are imagining that would not be involved in the day-to-day running of the military.
Correct. And would have, in a sense, no axe to grind in terms of whether or not we should have more aircraft carriers or fewer jet fighters. But let me
ask you about that. Someone might say, well, if they're not involved in running the military, how are they going to know what we can actually do, our actual capacity? Will they have that sort of tactile feel for what can be done?
Well, again, I would imagine that these wise men and wise women would be students of military affairs and students of national security policy. They may well, probably the great majority of them, mm-hmm. will have been retired professional officers. Mm-hmm. But again, some of them might be people who had served as civilians in the Secretary of Defense or people who had been academics. I'm not pushing the civilian piece, but I'm just saying We ought to be able to think more broadly about who can provide that kind of advice, high-quality advice, and the answer is not necessarily people who are wearing four stars on their shoulders.
In uniform, in command.
Correct.
But as I read it, it sounds wonderful, but isn't this problem, the place where civilian and military meet in the American system, is problematic by beautiful design, isn't it? I mean, how are you ever going to have advisors who are completely disinterested or don't have political agendas? Or is that achievable?
It may not be. And indeed, if we imagine that an administration comes to power and has a particular ideological point of view, then I suppose the president might just go ahead and pick advisors that he said, I know these people think the way I think. Now, I would hope that under this sort of system I'm outlining, that that set of advisors would have to be confirmed by the Senate. And so there might be some efforts to try to ensure that they weren't simply
right.
political hacks who
mm-hmm.
were chosen by the cronies chosen by the president. But let me also emphasize, the larger argument I'm trying to mm-hmm. promote here is mm-hmm. not that I have the answer to the problem. What I'm really trying to promote is there is a problem.
Right.
There is a problem that the system that we have evolved over the past 60 years that we call the Joint Chiefs of Staff doesn't work.
President Bush always says he's taking the advice of his military commanders. Is that a lie?
One hates to call the president a liar, but I have real doubts, especially based during the tenure of Secretary Rumsfeld, that military advice was being offered in a very forthright manner or was being welcomed. I have serious doubts about that.
So what do you do in a situation where the civilian leadership seemed to really want this war? In our system, do we want a military that's going to really push back and say no?
We want a military that is going to push back in the sense that these leaders will say to the people for whom they work, this is our judgment. This is what you must understand. But emphatically, the decisions are made must be made at the end of the day by the civilian leadership.
Are you sure those things have not been said within the Joint Chiefs in this war, the Iraq war, and just then,
it's very
transmogrified before they come out.
It's difficult for us to say. You know, when the archives are open 50 years, mm-hmm. the picture may look somewhat differently. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you cited a bit mm-hmm. earlier the mm-hmm. example of General Shinseki, mm-hmm. Who was at one moment somebody who did speak up, who did say he was testifying before a Senate committee.
Mm-hmm.
This occupation is going to be uglier and more complicated and more costly than we are imagining. And he was humiliated.
And we're reading this week in the New Yorker, Seymour Hersh reporting on General Taguba.
Yes.
Who, when he exposed Abu Ghraib, which was his job,
was punished. Was given a cold shoulder and basically shoved into retirement. And I suspect that within the ranks of the flag officers in the various services, they probably knew about his fate long before Seymour Hersh wrote about it in the New Yorker. So, again,
chilling effect.
To say that the Joint Chiefs system is broken mm-hmm. is not to say that the problem with our national security policy is exclusively reflecting a failure of the military. Heavens no. The primary responsibility for the debacle of Iraq rests with the president and with his inner circle of decision makers. But I do believe that the senior military leadership owns a piece of the responsibility.
Let's go to Jeff in Buffalo, New York. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. I'm a little nervous about asking this question. My question was about the parallels that people seem to be making with a lot of politicians looking for victory in Iraq. And it seems to me the parallels where we go back to World War II to find victory there, it seems to me that we're having a hard time figuring out which side we're on. In many ways, we are the invaders, and we supported the insurgents back in World War II. And in many ways, it seems to me that we're not able to see the big picture, which is maybe we're kind of fighting the problems that the Germans had, keeping the land that they had invaded. And I'm wondering if we're not seeing a little bit of something very ugly in history inside the people that are running our decision-making.
Okay,
well,
Andy?
Yeah, I endorse, I think, about 98.7% of what Stephen Van Evre said in the previous
talking
segment
about World War
II
lessons.
Making those comparisons and the principles that produce success there that have been disregarded. I do think the one piece that the comparison breaks down is, actually, I think you had a caller that was getting at this, is that this is not a war like that war. The Iraq war is not a war like that war, like World War II. And more broadly, I think, the national security threat posed by Islamic radicalism is not like the national security threat posed by National Socialism in Germany and by Japanese imperialism.
Jeff is suggesting that the U.S. is the bad guys this time. Has it come to that?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, the judgments about good guys and bad guys are very, very difficult to make. I'm afraid that we're not the bad guy. We're the stupid guy in terms of the way we've gotten ourselves into this predicament. Mm-hmm. But the larger point is that there are real limits to the comparisons we can make with World War II in terms of trying to understand how to go forward in Iraq at this point. Mm. Matter of fact, I would say that in an operational sense, there are very few lessons from World War II that could be applied to the battleground that is Iraq today.
10,000 pushing right now, we're told, after al-Qaeda outside of Iraq. But then Stephen Van Evre looking at very basic things, alliances, the best people, marshaling resources. I suppose these are almost indisputable. I want to go to the other part of your recent argument. We hear again and again in the presidential debates almost everybody standing up and saying, we are going to build a bigger U.S. military on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Barack Obama, McCain, Giuliani, Mitt Romney, all saying this. You say, wrong instinct, wrong idea.
Well, I think it's a cheap applause line in a sense. I mean, everybody knows that U.S. forces, land forces, are indeed overstretched. They are emphatically overstretched. And so it becomes an easy applause line for a would-be presidential candidate to say, you know, I'll expand the size of the Army and
the
Marine Corps.
But isn't it clear we're so stretched? People are going out again and again. Shinseki said we needed more troops at the get-go. To a layperson, it can easily make sense. By gosh, we better get more people in there.
But to recite that applause line, it seems to me, dodges the larger issue. And the larger issue is the strategic one. Now, if one thinks that, the way to win the global war on terror is to invade and, quote-unquote, liberate countries— You know, if indeed we think Iraq is a model for the future, then you betcha. I mean, then the problem of these speeches is that we don't need 100,000 new troops. We probably need about 500,000 or 1 million new troops.
Which nobody's talking about.
But the real question is that given the manifest failure of Iraq, what ought to be the principles that inform the way we are going to address the threat posed by Islamic radicalism? And invade and liberate countries just doesn't make any, ought not to make anybody's list of what those principles are.
What's your alternative vision?
Well, I think, again, and my intent here is not to say, you know, here's the three easy steps for a simple answer. If I could do that, then I'd be a famous guy. But I think that rather than thinking of the response to Islamic radicalism as finding ways to use American power to fix Islam, rather than trying to do that, which really is what the Bush administration has been attempting.
Fix Islam with a rifle.
We ought to try to contain the problem, to limit the problem, and which both recognizes the limits of our own power and also recognizes that to the extent that Islam is going to change and evolve, as it is, it's going to change and evolve in response to forces that come from inside the Islamic world. And what we want to do is to try to as best we can, to nudge gently that process in a direction that will lead to congenial relations between ourselves and the people of the Islamic world. That's a long project.
Mm. More
it's
patience,
not
less gunpowder.
It's not, in particular, a military project.
Let's go to Saeed in Boston. Saeed, you're on the air with Andrew Bacevich.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
I just want to make a comment and maybe sort of inject some reality into the rhetoric that's in general surrounding this war on terror. And my thought is that apparently the United States and its allies are allied with some of the most disgusting governments in the world, and with drug lords and warlords and people who are accused of war crimes, for example, people in Afghanistan. And by betraying the true values of democracy in the West, which is equality and freedom and justice and rule of law, and you know, for example, those debates are being ignored, and we're talking about very detailed technicalities, and what's happening is not a gentle nudge, but it's really a grab for the helm and say, you know, make a radical turn our way or you're dead.
Regime change, pushing out the battle of ideas. Saeed, our time is short, but Andy, what do you think?
Well, I do think that would be a fair description of the thinking within the Bush administration, probably between roughly September 12, 2001, and the president's second inaugural address.
Go for the head.
That we were going to be the sponsors of freedom and democracy, and it's our way or the highway. I think that those notions have been just utterly discredited by events, not simply events in Iraq, but for example, events in the West Bank and Gaza, in Lebanon, and that the problem is now this administration, in what really becomes its waning months, has no coherent set of principles to guide policy, and is now really engaged in simply improvising and making things up from day to day. We are, in that sense, I think, adrift.
Andrew Bacevich, you lost a son in Iraq, and we are sorry for that, and recently. You've been very clear since then that you do not want to politicize your son's death in any way, and we want to respect that and respect the privacy of your emotions. But I have to ask you how this private loss has affected your thinking about this very public issue, this war, these challenges.
Well, I have to say it hasn't affected my thinking at all. One needs to try to evaluate policy based on a set of principles informed by a sense of history. And the principles to which I subscribe and the understanding of history that I've come to persuaded me from the outset that this is an unnecessary war and a wrong-headed war. And observing it since, I long ago became persuaded that it's a utterly mismanaged and bungled war. And nothing that's happened to me personally has changed that.
That's a lot of academic discipline. Where does that come from? Your military background? Your commitment to...
Tom, I told you I wasn't going to talk about this. I'm not going to talk about it.
We've learned a lot already, and we appreciate it. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University. He's been writing a lot recently on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on the prospect of a bigger military, on the core issues in the war, the wars that we face. He's author of The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.